Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I am Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics of substance use and abuse.
Economics or economics?
Economics. You say
it's going
tomato.
To be about dollars and cents and what we're going to learn. I'm really excited about this. But substance abuse and criminal justice, we'll learn a lot today.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking forward to that.
I am too. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about fruits and veggies, maybe not a magic bullet for weight loss.
We're going to talk about and find out what you would prefer if you were to have another child, Christy. I know you. I see her her antenna going up here. Would you prefer more labor or more intense pain? We'll find out.
And how reliable is the drug information you find online, medication drug information?
And finally, we're going to talk about hookah. And we'll find out if Christy even knows what it is.
Well, I didn't a few minutes ago, but now I do. Okay, let's talk about fruits and veggies. We know they're good for you. We know everybody should eat more of them. We've talked a lot of different benefits from fruits and veggies. But the question is, if a doctor tells you or a nutritionist tells you to eat more fruits and veggies, will that help you lose weight?
Or do you think that you should lose weight that way? Would it be successful? And I would have said, well, maybe, but now after reading this article that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition surveying 1,200 people, I would say, not likely.
No, this was a study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that really showed that if people are recommended to eat more fruits and vegetables, they might eat more fruits and vegetables, but it doesn't contribute to eating overall less calories or to helping them lose weight.
Certainly might help out with fiber content, nutrients, a lot of other positive benefits, mental health maybe, but it's not going to lose weight. So not a weight loss strategy. And actually, as we start up our weight loss clinic at the Department of Family Medicine in the near future, Christy, we will not be including this as one of our strategies. But we'll
still
have
good
other
for
things.
You.
Stay tuned.
And let's talk about women, okay, and labor.
So what would you prefer, Christy? Let's say you were going to have another child, and rest assured to Christy's husband out there, I know nothing that anyone else doesn't know either here. No? Okay. But if you were, would you rather have a longer labor that has less pain or a shorter labor with greater pain?
Well, my perspective on that has changed after actually experiencing labor.
Shorter with more pain?
No, I'd rather have longer with less pain.
Okay.
For sure. And this was a study looking at only 40 women. So it was a small study asking them, and they were all people who were going to be induced. So not going into routine labor, but getting the medication and things to get their labor going on. And asked them before and after if they would prefer to have a fast labor with intense pain or a longer labor without so much pain.
This was in the British Journal of Anesthesia. So presumably these were all British women. And they found out that giving women surveys before they went into labor and then after they had delivered, not while in the middle of the labor, but these women kind of uniformly, or the majority of them, said they would rather have this longer labor with less pain. Though I also wondered, Christy, two things. Is this cultural? In other words, there are certain cultures that may not.
Sure.
And then the choice they were given, you know, would you like a shorter labor but maybe less vacuum extractions or less procedures to get the baby out and more pain? Or a longer labor with less pain, but maybe more procedures. I mean, you know, it depends on what the choice you give people.
Right, and how you frame it. And there are a lot of different variables. And there is a movement, certainly in our area, that a lot of people want to experience labor as natural as possible. The other thing that's really common in Great Britain that now we have in our hospital is the use of nitrous. It's like laughing gas that women can control their own pain control by putting that mask to their face. And so fewer people are getting epidurals. It's really a wonderful option for people. You're looking at me like I'm
crazy.
Well,
no, I'm just wondering if the men get to, you know, recently on a show we talked about, you know, the men getting involved in the housework. Maybe the men get involved in labor and get this laughing gas, and maybe it will cut down the whole anxiety of everyone.
I was like, I think the doctor should be able to try it, see what it is our patients are getting, but we can't.
Well, there's an interesting study, and I think it's certainly the getting patients involved in choices is a great thing. Speaking of choices, this next research that matters, Christy, was a report published in the New England Journal of Medicine about drug information and when changes to drugs are made, how does that information get to the public?
And so apparently, according to the study, most people search Wikipedia. It is the most frequently consulted online healthcare resource globally. And whenever something is changed from the FDA about medications or there's some new safety warning that comes out, really the question is, if people are going to Wikipedia, is Wikipedia updating fast enough to give people the most accurate information?
So the FDA, or the Food and Drug Administration, will issue drug safety warnings. And they found out that when they issue a drug safety warning, that searches on Google go up 82% in the week following, but Wikipedia goes up 175%. And so they actually took 22 prescription drugs over a two-year period and then saw, after the FDA issued these warning or changes, how frequently they were updated in Wikipedia. And they found that within 2 weeks, only about a third of them were updated. Another quarter, it was longer than 2 weeks there, and even a third were unchanged after a year.
Yeah, on average, it took 42 days to post the new information. So the most reliable place to go, one place to go, is the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, .gov, FDA.gov.
Food and Drug Administration, uh-huh.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah. To find the most accurate and timely information about medications, or talk with your doctor. We have all kinds of different little handy devices that we carry around to try to keep those things up to date.
Yeah, there are two Twitter accounts which we'll post on our website that listeners can subscribe to get these food and safety announcements. I do wonder, though, perhaps even on some of our own medical sites, we might be less likely to update them this quickly. So it maybe sounds bad about Wikipedia, but I think, you know, perhaps this is maybe not all bad news. In some respects, it was updated maybe more frequently than I even would have expected. So, you know,
more than in the past when it used to be wait until a new book got published. So
that's right.
I mean, it's progress.
Good point. Speaking of progress, let's talk about our very last research that matters about hookah. And I know when we first talked about this research, you were like, what's hookah, Adam?
I know. I'm sorry to expose my naivete.
Well, that's why it's research that matters, Christy, because this is an important issue that I would say at least 20-25% of American young adults and teens know about.
So apparently, although cigarette use is declining among young people, that is really good, this hookah use or hookah smoking is gaining in popularity, and nearly one out of five high school seniors reported using this water pipe device to smoke hookah.
Yeah,
I guess it tastes good or...
Well, these alternative forms of tobacco, including hookah and smokeless tobacco and even e-cigarettes and others, have gained in real popularity because for some people, they don't think of themselves as smokers. They can smoke through a water pipe in these hookah bars on college campuses around the country at a very social, and flavors and fruits and smells that are very aromatic. And then there's this mistaken assumption that it's safe, which it is not. The same risk as combustible tobacco are likely there in hookah, which is a smoked tobacco product.
So it still has the tobacco in it. It still has all those cancer-causing agents, just like if you were smoking cigarettes. And it's just as dangerous, although you feel like it's more sophisticated, I guess.
Certainly. And it's not confined to those who maybe have less disposable income or lower educational status, like cigarettes increasingly are. But this is actually seen in people with higher disposable income. And so it just shows that we need to stay vigilant. We need to work on tobacco use reduction.
It said that if among the 5,500 high school seniors, the risk factors were living in a big city, having more highly educated parents, obviously not my children, and having higher weekly income from a job or other source. So if you were from a higher status or you had more money or you had more highly educated parents, maybe those who don't know about hookah, you're more likely to use it.
You need to go home and ask your children.
I do.
Because they're highly educated.
She
they probably
be doing
know about it.
Yet.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Chris. We've had a good chance to not only talk about hookah, but also fruits and veggies not being a bullet to lose weight.
And that some women prefer longer labor over more intense pain.
And if you really want the most reliable drug information updates, go to the FDA and go to their Twitter.
Well, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics or economics of substance abuse and use. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics of substance use and abuse.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Zarkin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we're talking about you and your role at RTI International, but for our listeners, help us understand, what is RTI International and how did you come to be there and so interested in substance abuse?
Lots of questions there.
I know, lots at once.
Yeah,
sorry,
lots at one time. Well, RTI is a independent, not-for-profit research institute that's located in Research Triangle Park. It was founded in 1958 by the Triangle Universities and a businessman in North Carolina. And it's a organization that spans the globe, if you will, of disciplines. It's very similar to a university in that it has work in life sciences and laboratories, social sciences, and in engineering. And we look at health, education, international development, survey and statistics, social and economic policy, energy and environment. So it's really like a university.
So it's research in all those different areas. Exactly. But
how did you get particularly interested in substance abuse, criminal justice, this whole field of all the fields of life sciences and health?
So I started my research career in trained as a labor economist, looking at labor markets. And when I came to RTI, which is really what's called a soft money organization, where you have to get funding for your research, you have to look for areas where people are going to support your research. So it turned out that in my area of labor economics, it was very difficult to get funding in that. The Department of Labor didn't have a lot of funding in that area. So I started working with people that looked at the labor market aspects of substance abuse, the impact of taking drugs on labor market outcomes and this kind of thing. And I slowly got pulled into this whole field, and then really been working in that field really for the last 20 years.
So when you say the labor market impact on substance abuse, translate that. What does that mean in plain language?
Well, for example, does substance abuse affect the number of hours that you spend in the labor market? Does it have an impact on whether you're employed or not? Does it have an impact on your wages? And that was the entry point that got me involved in the whole host of things in substance abuse. But I went from that area, for example, to looking at the cost of substance abuse treatment. At that time, when I first started in the field, there really was not a lot of work in costing substance abuse. And one of the first components of doing an economic analysis is identifying the cost of care. And so I was part of a team that helped identify some of those costs and been really working in that area for quite a while on the costing side of treatment.
So I find it interesting, and I should, for our listeners, say I've known Dr. Zarkin professionally and personally for many years now. But this marriage that you do and that lead at RTI on behavioral health and criminal justice. So we're kind of getting into the behavioral health and the substance abuse side. Why criminal justice? Where does that fit in? And how did this portfolio and this marriage of the two, does it make sense?
That's a great question, Adam. Well, a lot of people, for example, in prison have substance abuse problems. And in fact, it can be people who have substance abuse problems may be more likely to commit crimes, which I think, in fact, is really what you see. People are jailed and in prison with substance abuse problems, so a lot of people in state prisons have those kind of problems as well. And so there's a very natural connection. On the mental health side, so we look at substance abuse, mental health, and criminal justice in our division. Many people who are in prison as well have mental health problems. And so substance abuse, mental health are very common among prisoners. And people who have mental health problems can also commit more crimes, as well as substance abuse and mental health. So I'm sorry if I...
This interconnectedness,
right?
And I guess, and I'm sure we'll be talking much about the rest of the show about kind of treatment and what we know in the economics. But I suspect kind of the prelude question I have is, can you treat one without treating all of them when you have these three different kinds of issues going on?
Well, that's a great question. What happens, a lot of people have multiple problems, as you noted. So they may have an alcohol problem, an illicit drug problem. They may be smoking cigarettes, and they may have mental health problems as well.
And could be incarcerated.
Well, one of the challenges of being incarcerated is they don't have very good treatment systems. But let me move back away from this for a moment. For people who in the community who have all those problems, oftentimes one of the challenges, we don't treat all those diseases at the same time. We tend to have alcohol treatment programs or drug treatment programs. And we oftentimes don't take account of the fact that there are so-called comorbid conditions, that they are co-occurring. So that's a challenge in the treatment world on handling all those things at one time.
I want to continue our conversation into treatment and the complexity of those different factors. But you mentioned tobacco abuse and alcohol abuse and other drugs. What are the most common illicit drugs, as you refer to them, that you find in that population of people in prison?
Well, I'm not sure about prison per se, but you'll find that one of the most common drugs that people abuse is marijuana. And that's probably the most abused drug out there. Although I have to say, even backing up a second, alcohol is probably the most common drug. So even though we oftentimes think of alcohol as different from illicit drugs, it is a drug, it's a very powerful drug, and it's one that's widely abused in our society. Marijuana is very common out there. Those are probably the two most commonly abused drugs, along with tobacco. But again, we have a different kind of addiction issues associated with tobacco.
Mm-hmm. So I want to add in another area that I know that you study, your division studies, which is prescription drug abuse. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that from the work that your division does in helping the American public understand this in a different way.
Well, as you know, one of the major problems now is that individuals are in some ways being overprescribed opioid pain relievers. And sometimes they overuse them, and they become addicted to those prescription drugs. It's actually getting so problematic at times that people, that when they are having trouble getting the opioid painkillers, they may actually go out and try to buy heroin because they need that opioid drug. And it's cheaper oftentimes, if they can't get access to prescription drugs, to buy heroin in the open market as opposed to black market or so-called illegal drugs on the prescription drug market. So it's a major problem. You see celebrities are having problems with this. And actually almost anyone out in society that's being prescribed these drugs is at risk for having an addiction problem. And many people are now addicted to opioid painkillers.
It's a very sad and real thing that we see. We see it so often in our office, and we're grateful that you're doing research to help people understand it and to try to attack that.
What is what we don't know about the economics? Help us begin to start and unravel what we mean by economics of substance use and abuse.
Or when you're talking about how much it costs for the nation, how do you even approach that?
Well, there's several things to look at. There are, as you've noted, people do estimate the cost of alcohol and drug abuse in our society. And what they look for are economic indicators such as reduced productivity. They work less in the labor market, higher health care costs associated with drug abuse, higher crimes that are created, and therefore there's costs of crimes. Economists can put a dollar value on the cost of those crimes. And when we put people in prison for drug problems, there's also associated prison and jail costs that are higher due to drugs. And so when you pull all that together, there's substantial costs of substance abuse in the world, and in the U.S. in particular. And some of the estimates are approximately $200 billion per year for the cost of illicit drugs. And actually, on the cost of excess alcohol, people have estimated approximately another $200 billion. Mm. So there's huge social costs associated with alcohol and drug abuse in our society.
Well, we do want to launch into some further conversation about treatment programs, what works, how much they cost, what's available to people. But we need to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics of substance use and abuse. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics of substance use and abuse. And Dr. Zarkin, I know you and your colleagues, when you're given and you develop a new research contract and you go about looking at determining the cost of a program, as an economist, how do you do it? And who are the constituencies? Who are the people that really care passionately about this?
Well, let me take the last part first. One of the reasons why we do an economic analysis is because the resources are scarce. That is, we have lots of things that we want to do with our resources, but we only have a limit on the resources that we have available. So as an economist, you have to make choices, and we want to help. Economics is really the science of helping people make those choices. So one of the first steps in helping make that choice is figuring out what the cost of any intervention or activity is. And so the first step, do a cost analysis. In particular, if we're talking about methadone, we would figure out how much does it cost to provide treatment in a methadone clinic.
People who are addicted to...
To heroin.
Heroin, okay.
Okay. And so methadone, as you probably well know, is a therapy that's given. It's actually an opioid in itself that's really a substitution for heroin. One of the reasons why the people go to methadone as opposed to heroin, it basically, and I'm going to defer to you guys on the medical side, but it grabs the same receptors as you see in heroin, but unlike heroin, which has these very highs and lows, it really levels those out. So people can be very much able to do their work and live a very productive life on methadone. And many people can live 20, 30, 40 years on methadone care. So there's a great advantage of having methadone as opposed to heroin. And so what we do in terms of the costing, though, is we look at the inputs on how treatment is produced. So to produce treatment in a methadone clinic, you have to have a lot of labor. And you have people that are spending time on individual counseling and on group counseling and also giving people their methadone doses. And so what you want to do is you look at the inputs, and the major input is labor, and you figure out how much time is spent, for example, supplying labor focused on methadone treatment. And then you look at the other components that are used. For example, building space, how much space is used, are you allocating it properly? And you go through all the factors that are used to basically provide treatment. And that's the basic process that we'll use in any kind of costing algorithm.
But then you're also trying to compound the analysis with the benefits of having people able to work and able to function and to contribute to society, which makes that even more complex, I would imagine.
Right. So when you do a cost-benefit study, say, of a methadone program, you're going to want to measure the cost that we've already talked about, and they're going to want to measure the benefits that you've alluded to. So are people working more when they get out of treatment? Are they committing fewer crimes? Do their healthcare costs decrease? Are there fewer costs associated with policing or other kind of incarceration costs that go along with the fact that maybe fewer crimes are committed? So all those components are collected. We'll look at the change in those values, and then we'll put a dollar value on each of those and then add them all up to get the benefits associated with that. So then a policymaker can look at the costs and benefits of treatment and then say, wow, it looks like the benefits exceed the costs. And in fact, if you look at the literature on methadone treatment, the benefit-cost ratio is on the order of 4 to 1. So for every dollar spent on methadone treatment, there's basically $4 of benefits that are basically generated. So it's very cost-beneficial to do that.
Is that sort of data, once you develop it, is that easily understood? How do you spend time communicating that to policymakers and kind of getting that data out there? Because I imagine I haven't seen methadone treatment clinics on the cutting block, so to speak. But maybe that's because it's so well accepted. You've done your job so well.
I wish that were the case. I'm not sure that's the case. You know, methadone has a controversial component to it because people are saying that you are basically substituting one opioid for another. And so some people push back on that. And there are issues of what's the proper dose. Sometimes it gets diverted. Some people can take it and there can be fatalities associated with it if it gets diverted to a child. So it's not without its own controversial elements to it. Some places and some states may not support methadone treatment. Some countries may not be supporting methadone treatment. So some, it's not universally accepted. There are methadone programs in North Carolina, and they've been very successful, I think, again, at treating people. It's interesting. Another thing that's important to understand about substance abusers, oftentimes substance abusers are marginalized in society. Although substance abuse can affect all people in society, sometimes we look at people who are on the lower end of the scale who are substance abusers, and there may not be a lot of sympathy for people like that. And sometimes I think policymakers don't give the right amount of resources for people that they view as on the marginalized end of things.
Well, and you talked earlier about this link and the strong association between people in prison and how common it is for people in prison to have problems with substance abuse and all of the complexity of those relationships. And in thinking about the importance of helping people before we release them back to society, there are a lot, I know you've done some research around thinking through what sort of treatment programs within the prison system can be helpful to people. What do we know and what should our policymakers know about that?
That's a great question, Christy. What you find is that the majority of people in prison have a substance abuse problem, a problem that can be addressed and to some extent by treatment. It turns out also when you look at people who are released from treatment who are substance abusers, they're more likely to commit crimes if they're substance abusers. So a logical thing that you might ask is, well, if that's the case, why don't we treat more people in prison when we have them incarcerated? After all, they're a captive audience. They're not going anywhere. And that's one of the challenges when you're in the community-based setting. People may not come back to treatment, but people aren't going to leave your prison quite as easily. And so a question that is obviously raised, is an obvious question to raise, is why aren't we improving the treatment system and why aren't we treating more people in the prison treatment system? So what we wanted to do, and we did actually a study, to ask that question, what are the benefits and costs of increasing access to prison-based treatment and also increasing the quality of that treatment? It turns out that the quality of prison treatment is relatively poor, but we did two dimensions of that policy question. And one of the things that we wanted to incorporate in that study was to take account of the following. Drug abuse and drug dependence is a chronic condition, much like diabetes. So people aren't necessarily going to treatment one time and immediately cured. There's no magic bullet. People go through periods of use, followed by maybe going to treatment, maybe some time where they're off of drugs, but then they may reinstitute use again, and then they have to go back to treatment again. And that may happen multiple times. Very similar to a diabetic that may be in blood sugar control, falls out, and then comes back into blood sugar control. So it's a chronic condition, substance abuse, much like diabetes. So what we wanted to do when we did our economic analysis is look at the long-term implications of this. And that's actually one of the features that's really a signature of this work that we did, is taking account of the chronicity, the chronic nature of drug abuse. And so what we really wanted to do, ideally, would be having a long-term study of tracking people, that tracked people over time as they used drugs and then fell out of treatment and went in and out of treatment. And basically, we get some information from that. But there is no Framingham study like we have that tracks people with coronary heart
Framingham
disease.
Framingham study was that big international study that really looked at heart disease risk factors and tracked
over
people for
time.
Decades.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And it would be great to have that for drug abuse, but we don't have that. So what we had to do is create what's called a simulation model. We basically created hypothetical individuals as they went through their lifetime, starting them in state prison, and then running them through their lifetime until they became age 60. And we did that by piecing together bits of data. We took information from clinical trials, we took information from data sets, and we said, well, how might people at different ages behave if they behave like people in this and that clinical trial? And we basically created like an artificial person, if you will, with these transition probabilities, what's the probability, for example, they would start using drugs or reusing drugs if they weren't using drugs before? What's the probability they go back into treatment? And we created this basically again, an artificial person, if you will.
Well, this is a critical area of the work that you're doing. And I think hearing the economic voice, it's dollars and cents. And appreciate you sharing your common sense and your research expertise with your health listeners.
Thank you for being with us, Dr. Zarkin.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Gary Zarkin, Director of Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, about the economics of substance use and abuse. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if a listener has a question or concern, where should they send it, Christy?
They should send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. We've got some great questions today about a tick bite and travel to Costa Rica with a baby.
About an aging parent living at home and an aging parent that has a positive TB skin test. What to do? Erica Lloyd, our executive producer, will ask her to read our very first House Call.
I'm taking my 7-month-old to Costa Rica to visit family for a few weeks. Is there anything particular about traveling with a 7-month-old you can advise me? She's pretty easygoing, so I really don't have anything to worry about, I don't think.
Well, first off, I think you need to take a family doctor with you to go to Costa Rica.
I mean, this sounds like a place that's really dangerous.
Maybe a family doc, maybe a co-host of a radio show too could go down there and be there and, you know, to advise
you. Just to supervise the 7-month-old and hang out. But, you know, it sounds like if you have family down there that you have some experience traveling to Costa Rica, which probably makes it safer and a little bit easier for you. I would recommend that you make sure she's had her 6-month shots before you take her and that you do those routine safety measures like watching out for clean water. If you're breastfeeding, to continue breastfeeding and trying to make good choices for your own health around safe water and around avoiding infections.
Yeah, you know, the risks are not great there, but the risk might be to you as a mother. And passing it on to your child. So do you have your hepatitis A vaccination as a mother? And you making sure that you're healthy because we assume, but maybe not, that this child could be breastfeeding, you know? Mm-hmm.
And
if the child gets sick, where could you go for care? Have that really lined up in case you need that.
That's true. And there, I mean, a lot of people are traveling to Costa Rica right now. If you have family there, then you know the areas that where you're more likely to have problems with infections. And many of those areas are perfectly safe to drink the water. So I would just investigate it well and just think carefully about protecting your little sweet baby.
What's our very next House Call, Erica?
My mom is 85, has dementia, and still lives at home. It's been a really long road, but since we got a nurse to come to the house each day for medications and safety, she's been able to live at home as desired. I'm so grateful, and I want to let others know that there are ways to keep your parents at home.
Well, that's a really good piece of information to share with all of our listeners, and we're really glad to know that, you know, she's doing well and able to maintain either at her home or at your home or sometimes both.
Mm-hmm. There are several different ways to help respect and recognize people's desire to stay at home, even with dementia. And there is something called a PACE program, where PACE, the program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, will pick people up in the morning and then drive them back at night after taking care of them, or ways that you can get a nurse in the home as you have. You can consult the internet for the Department on Aging. We have one in our area, but you can look for resources in your area that may give you other ideas and resources to be helpful for you and your family.
Sometimes a geriatric social worker can be really, really helpful. And whereas having a nurse come every day could be expensive and sometimes people may not be able to afford it, perhaps having a home care aide, which is someone who's trained in home care but not necessarily at the pay rate of a nurse, could be very helpful. So that nurse to come out and help get things set up and then working with a home care aide on a more regular basis. Lots of different things. But the biggest thing is trying to keep our elderly in environments that are more fitting and natural for many of them. If we can do that, I think that's a great thing. And sometimes we're kind of coming back to the future sort of thing.
It's true. And I'm just so glad to hear that you've had success and feel good about the direction you're heading with your mom. So we're happy for you. Thanks for sharing.
What's our very next house call, Erica?
My granddaughter lives in a group home and is doing great. She's had a yearly PPD test for tuberculosis and has always come back negative. This year, the test came back positive and a blood test confirmed she had been exposed to TB. She has no symptoms, but the doctor recommends treatment. Should I be worried about her long-term health?
You know, I'm sorry that you're having to go through this, and that whole process is scary to think about tuberculosis, but it's also a blessing that the group home does that routine test, because that allows her to, I mean, it sounds like you've picked it up early if she's always been negative in the past. And by doing the treatment for what we call latent tuberculosis infection, or you'll see it listed as LTBI, by doing that treatment early before one gets active tuberculosis, that is actually good prevention with excellent rates of preventing it from ever becoming active tuberculosis that can be life-threatening.
Yeah, it kind of like builds this huge wall around the tuberculosis bacteria there, and that wall just kind of contains it for the rest of one's life there. And what's also really nice about this particular situation is that she was tested the previous year and it's been negative. And checking on a regular basis, you can say, well, something's changed more recently, changed, and she's been exposed, to something more recently. So that's where almost everyone, I think, would really agree that she should be treated. If she had had a positive PPD, but we don't know when it happened, then there's a lot more questions and difficulty involved. But kudos to the group home. They're doing their job. And when anyone's moving into a new home situation, people require the TB skin test. We take it seriously, and so should you.
And from here on out, your granddaughter will probably continue to be positive from that skin test. And so the recommendation would be that she has just a yearly chest x-ray to monitor for any development of that TB over time.
Erica, what's our very last house call about a tick?
I found a tick on the back of my head, pulled it off, and killed it. I never got sick or anything. However, that was over 1 month ago, and I still have a tiny itchy bump on the back of my head. Is this common with a tick bite?
Yuck on finding a crawling tick on the back of your head, but good for you for getting it off.
And yuck on pulling it off, and yuck on killing it, maybe with your fingers. I don't know how, or a smash with a hammer.
In my house, we burn them.
Yeah, ticks, I've yet to find them, people who keep them as pets. But it's probably not uncommon to actually have this itchy bump on the back of your head. And there's a couple different reasons for why it might have occurred.
I mean, part of it is just what you call a local reaction, where you can have a little bit of inflammation and just irritation on your skin from having had a bite, just like you might in other kinds of insect bites.
Yeah, those ticks can leave saliva and literally yucky things that are foreign to your skin, and they deposit those, and then your skin's like reacting and says, get rid of this, but it doesn't really know how to get rid of it because it forms a kind of a inflammation there under the skin. The other thing is, you may not have actually gotten all the tick. You might have left the head in there,
or a leg,
or other parts in there, an eye, and that can be again very irritating to the skin. And those two things actually aren't treated in exactly the same way, because you might have to take a cream to get rid of that inflammation, but you actually might occasionally have to get that foreign body if there's a part of the tick in there. Either an injection, or sometimes you can have to have it a little punched out with a little skin procedure. Hopefully, most of the time it cures.
Yeah, eventually your body will probably get rid of it. As long as you're not having fever or feeling sick, it sounds like you've been doing fine. Then the rest is sort of, how much is it bothering you? Is it worth going and getting somebody to take a look at it for a cream or for maybe digging in there?
Yeah.
Good luck to you.
We totally agree. This is totally yucky, icky, all those kind of great medical terms.
Try not to scratch it. Okay.
That'll conclude the house calls for today. We've had a good chance to talk about tick bites as well as TB skin test among people living in group homes.
About dementia and the elderly trying to stay in your own home.
And about Christy and I want to go with you to Costa Rica.
That's right.
Well, we hope that we've addressed issues that are important to you today. And if you have any of your own health concerns, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can also follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Gary Zarkin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.